We turn now to a series of terms that are used to describe the Ministry of Healing and Transformation, which is, of course, a primary focus of the ministry of Christ, but which also then becomes a way of describing Christ's followers. And that's especially true of the title iatros, which means healer or physician in antiquity. Christ, the divine physician, becomes a metaphor in the early church, which is even more important in its own way than the idea of Christ or God, the judge. Christ is understood as being the manifestation of the God who has the power to heal all ills, who saves as an act of healing, of restoring that which is lacking in human nature. So it's a reflection of God's infinite compassion, and Christ's own ministry of healing, his own miracles of healing, are not only events in themselves, but they point more clearly to who Christ is, the God of infinite compassion with the power to heal. And this healing, in the other terms that we'll be considering, and especially in light of the image or icon of Christ's transfiguration, then comes to be understood as a kind of representation of a healing that reaches not only into the depths of the human soul, but also has the power to affect and to touch all of creation. The metamorphosis, the transformation, the transfiguration, literally, of Christ, so that one sees who he is on the Mount of Transfiguration, also becomes a way of describing our own transfiguration. This exact same term is used by St. Paul to describe what happens within ourselves as we gaze upon, as we engage in this ministry of receiving the grace of God from Christ, and ourselves become touched, healed, and transformed. It's a transformation that ultimately reaches out to embrace the whole of creation. And there's the very controversial doctrine of the restoration, the ultimate healing and transformation of the universe, seen as being God's ultimate goal. This title or this image of healer, of transformer, which represents part of who Christ is of course the kind of window which is provided also through an understanding of the sacraments. The transfiguration becomes an icon that stands for, that represents the God who is both present in matter and who has the power to transform matter into a means of communion with himself through the water of baptism, but in an especially and more vivid way through the Eucharist, in which material things, bread and wine, become literally God. They become the presence of God himself. Ours is a God who delights in doing that to the material universe. And if he does it to the Eucharist, then he delights also in doing it within the hearts of human beings. So this language of healing, of transformation, renewal and restoration also applies to sacramental experience and is a way of describing the developing understanding of the sacraments and their healing role in the early church as well, although we won't have as much time to look at that aspect of things. Let's drop down to section one, healer. I've chosen as a picture, as an icon, as a way of describing this ministry, the taking of Christ in the garden, Christ being seized by the soldiers from the Belle Heure, the very beautiful hours of the Duke of Berry. These are manuscript illuminations for books of ours. And in this very beautiful depiction, you have the classical Western depiction of Christ being seized in the garden. Acts of violence surround him. There are swords drawn, weapons drawn, a lamp above his head has gone out to symbolize the darkness of violence with which he's surrounded. Judas is betraying him with a kiss. Even Peter, the disciple, is sheathing his violent sword after having reached out in a pathetic act of striking one of the most defenseless individuals there. And in the midst of all this violence, even as violence is being perpetrated on him, Christ reaches out and heals. This is a very powerful image of who God is. God is the one who, even in the midst of violence, transforms violence into healing. Christ can take all of that and distill it down and create out of it a possibility of new life and of healing. So this is a kind of a reminder of what this term, what the idea of healing will mean, and how it's beautifully symbolically depicted in the later Western tradition in this image taken from the Hours of the Duke of Berry. Well, let's look at the terms themselves, beginning with number 1-1. In the ancient world, the idea of a iatros, of a physician or a healer applying to to a god is very common in antiquity. The gods are referred to as healers in a universal and in an interior sense. But if you look at the shrines of healing in antiquity, the shrines of Asclepius and a variety of others, where people went on pilgrimage in the ancient world in order to be healed of their illnesses through the experience of sleeping at the shrine and then receiving the visitation of the god and possibly being healed, and there were often medical attention available at these shrines as well. In the descriptions of these healings, and it's the reason for the reference to not without an element of caprice, there's a strong tendency to blame those who are not healed as being unworthy of the god's attention, or not having sufficient faith, or not having whatever it took in order to be healed. So the notion of classical antiquity is not so much healing as a reflection of the compassion of the deity, but also a reflection of the defect of those who are not healed, which of course we do not find as a principal focus in the description of the miracles of healing of Jesus. So in the Old Testament, healing is described as primarily coming from Yahweh, coming from God, in the sense that he is withdrawing his judgment, withdrawing that sickness or national calamity, which was especially in the Deuteronomic school seen as being a consequence of sin. Thus, the necessary precondition for healing was the forgiveness of sins. So Old Testament understandings of healing and the necessity for the forgiveness of sins are deeply linked, and we can see how this is a presupposition of the population at the time of Jesus' own ministry. And if we look at section 1, 2, 3, the work of the servant of God in Isaiah will also involve a vicarious suffering for the sake of the healing, the expiation of the sins of the people. By his suffering, by his stripes, we are healed. Then, in the New Testament, sickness is seen in a completely new way. Jesus does not believe in, does not preach, and even overturns the doctrine of sin as the cause of sickness. For him, the fact that a person is ill, the fact that a person has a particular infirmity, does not mean that they sinned or that their ancestors sinned. Part of the gospel is to set this aside and to allow one to see Jesus' ministry of healing as the work of God, the great physician. God, the one who is going to, capable of, desirous of healing all the ills in human experience. So, the most common means of healing is Jesus' word of power, dropping down to 1, 3, 4. The miracles have a material point outside the miracle itself. The miracles of healing are not just about healing. For example, in St. Mark's Gospel, the healing of the man with the withered hand is not just an example of the healing of the individual. It's an opportunity to remember that it's a discovery of what the Sabbath is really for. It's for experiencing that grace of God that includes healing. And although Christ is described in that gospel as looking around with anger at those who have hardness of heart, again, that anger is somehow transmuted, transformed into healing, into an act of compassion. So in 1:3-5, the miracles of Jesus are powerful signs that the age of salvation is beginning to be fulfilled. And if we drop down to 1:3-6, the essential thing is not just the healing itself. These actions are signs. They point beyond themselves. They give us an indication of who God is, who Christ is. And so healing in the context of the developing tradition of the church is a reflection of and is a means of facilitating the preaching of the good news of who Christ is and who the Father is. So if we drop down to section 1:4 in the early church, Christ the great physician becomes an important metaphor. It's also based, very interestingly, on something one finds in Plato. Plato writes, and this is important for us with an interest in the idea of spiritual guidance and direction, Plato writes in Protagoras that the philosopher should be a physician of souls, should be capable of healing or curing the spiritual ills of others. So this Platonic background is fulfilled in a beautiful physical and even transcendent way by Christ himself. And then in Clement of Alexandria, the Word of God is the healer of those passions, and that means addictions and compulsions of the soul that are contrary to nature. If we drop down to the next term, or the next two terms, transformation, metamorphosis, and renewal, anakinosis, these are the terms, and especially the term metamorphosis, that is translated as transfiguration. And so I've given you that picture of the transfiguration, which is one of the earliest Christian depictions of this image. It's from the monastery of St. Catherine on Mount Sinai. It survived the destruction of icons in the later 7th and 8th centuries in the East, primarily because the monastery of St. Catherine was under Muslim control, and the soldiers of the emperor could not get to it in order to destroy the icons there. The soldiers of the Christian emperor interested in destroying all icons that were not images of himself. But that aside, this image shows the transfiguration as an event that shines upon and transfigures the disciples. John is standing with hands outstretched in Oron's posture, receiving the light that comes from Christ. And in many ways, this is a fulfillment of the text that I'd like to use as the background for our consideration of this term, and that's both 2 Corinthians 3 and Romans 12. In 2 Corinthians 3, he describes the veil that covered the face of Moses, but now he says in verse 17, we with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being changed. Metamorphoumetha. We are being transfigured into the likeness of Christ. Tain autain ekona, into his image, into his likeness, from one degree of glory to another. So St. Paul describes a vision of Christ that transfigures, and this is the same word that's used in the Gospels to describe Jesus' transfiguration, that transfigures us. We are being changed as we gaze upon the Lord, changed from one degree of glory to another. And in Romans 12, he links this word, transfiguration, which is translated here as transformation, but it's the same word, again, metamorphousthe, transformed by the renewal, the anokinose, the renewal of your mind. Don't be conformed to this word, but be transfigured by the transformation, by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good, acceptable, and perfect. So for St. Paul, this word, transfiguration and renewal, are words that describe what happens to us who gaze upon, that is to say, who receive from Christ the gift both of faith, of perception of who he is, and the power to act as he did. Well, let's look at these terms, having sort of, if you will, focused on them in Paul. Now let's look at the exegesis of these terms, first of all, in classical antiquity, in section 2.1. The term metamorphosis, classical antiquity, describes it as literally a transfiguration, which is a transformation into another form that is understood as pertaining to the gods and goddesses. This is what they do in order to manifest themselves to human beings. There's a parallel idea in the Hellenistic mystery religions, very popular at the time of the early church, of regeneration or deification connected with this transfiguration. It was something that the initiates into the mystery religions believed was happening to them. And the word anakinosis in classical Greek literally means to make new, to renew. If we look at these terms in the Old Testament, or at least at a transfiguration or transformation, metamorphosis, we find that in Jewish apocalyptic tradition, there is a transformation that is a gift of eschatological salvation that the blessed are going to receive after the resurrection. This is a way of describing what will happen to all of those who are faithful once they are raised from the dead. And it's also described of Enoch during his great ascent into heaven. So it's used in the Jewish apocalyptic tradition to describe something that happens to those who are approaching near to the throne of glory. If we then look at the New Testament, of course, the central term, metamorphosis, is transfiguration. It means transformation, but it's most commonly translated as transfiguration. This is what the disciples see on Mount Tabor. They are seeing who Christ is, who God is, and also they see what is promised to the disciples. What happens to Jesus will happen to others in the eschaton. We see him for more than just a man. We perceive him as God, and we realize that God is also remaking, transforming our own hearts. And so in sections 232 and 233, there is a discussion of these passages which we've already looked at, a process in which Christians are themselves undergoing an unceasing and progressive change into the image of the one whose glory they see, a reattainment of the divine likeness of humanity at creation. So this transfiguration, this renewal, is a recovery of that which was originally God's gift to us at the beginning, which is why the notion of a return, of a restoration also lies behind that, and why we need to look, if briefly, at that term as well. And then in section 233, Kittel notes that the Spirit is already in possession of Christians in virtue of the presence of Spirit in whom the risen Lord is himself present. The transformation begins already and from within, though not only inwardly. We are being refashioned according to the likeness of the Lord. So for St. Paul and for the later Christian tradition, the transfiguration of Jesus is also a hint, a foretaste, a glimpse into a process that takes place within the depths of the human heart, describable in sections 234 and 235 as a renewal, becoming a new person, becoming an entirely new creation, which is to say, that which we were originally intended to be. In the later Byzantine, in the later Eastern Christian tradition, this image or icon of the Transfiguration will be a particularly important way of understanding what in the hesychastic tradition is believed to be the significance of the light which those who practice the Jesus Prayer, and remember, the Jesus Prayer is not the Lord's Prayer. The Jesus Prayer in the Eastern Christian churches is the prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, sometimes added to the end of that, have mercy on me, a sinner. And in the Eastern traditions, the Orthodox traditions in particular, especially in Russia and in Greece, that prayer is prayed constantly, especially by monks and nuns. And those who do that as their primary form of prayer are called hesychasts, for hezukia, inward stillness or silence. Well, I mention that because in that tradition, the icon of the Transfiguration, the glory of Christ, the light that shines from the face of Christ on Mount Tabor, is felt to be an explanation of why practitioners of this particular kind of prayer often describe an experience of the inward indwelling light of God. Their greatest exponent, St. Gregory Palamas in the 14th century, describes that light that they see or experience as the uncreated light of Tabor. So the image of the Transfiguration becomes of significance in the later Byzantine tradition, especially as a way of describing our own inward appropriation of or experience of a kind of light that happens during prayer. And that is certainly in keeping with St. Paul's notion that in, as it were, gazing on the Lord, we are being refashioned, reshaped more and more into God's image. And then finally, something that we should spend a lot of time on, but will not have a significant amount of time at this moment, the word apokatastasis, which means restoration. In the ancient world, it literally meant restitution to an earlier state. It was especially used in cosmology or in astronomy or astrology to describe the idea that periodically the constellations return to their original position. There's an annual return, but there are subtle changes which take place that mean that it really is only every 25,000 years or so that things actually do return to the place where they were. The position of the stars really is the same as it once was, and this was known in antiquity. So there was a notion that this reflected a kind of divine cycle, a series of cycles in which there would be a restoration to an earlier state. And among the Platonists, especially the Neoplatonists after Plotinus, this was a way of describing this word, apokatastasis, was a way of describing the cycles of regeneration or metempsychosis or maybe even reincarnation that were believed to characterize the philosophically minded soul ascending towards union with the One. Now, in the Old Testament, this term, apokatastasis, or its verbal forms, describe the restoration of Israel to its own land by Yahweh. So it's a kind of an eschatological hope. The apokatastasis is a way of describing that which will be restored. God will restore what once was, and ultimately, it involves a kind of a hope that reaches both into time but even beyond time. And it's rather parallel to, and certainly influenced perhaps by, the Greek notions of a sort of a cosmic restoration. In the New Testament, there is a kind of messianic sense used in the book of Acts, in which the disciples ask, "Will you not restore?" And the term here is that Greek word, the verbal form of apokatastasis, the state of Israel. And it becomes a way of describing the conviction or the hope that God will restore the universe to a state that it only knew at its very beginning. Now, this becomes problematic or difficult in the early church. Origen is perhaps the greatest example of one who professed belief in the apokatastasis as what we would today call universalism, a belief that, to use its slightly more orthodox form, in the writings of Saint Isaac of Nineveh, the idea that on the last day there will only be the love of God, the burning, fiery love of God, which will be experienced as bliss by the saved, but as pain by those who choose to remain in separation from God. God restores the state of union with Himself. The problem remains that what about those who don't desire union and desire to be isolated? Well, for them, union would be experienced as pain and goes by the name of hell. Now, will that endure forever, or will those souls that separate themselves from God ultimately, over endless eons, finally be reconciled? That's the problem of the if you will, heretical aspect of the doctrine of the apokatastasis, on which we may have occasion to comment later in the course.